Good morning. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Stephen Bean. I am an elder candidate for the church. I have been told by one person that I have their vote, so things are looking up. But I have the opportunity to share with you guys this morning for our preaching time, and I'm nerve-sighted to do so. My family and I just got back yesterday from a trip to Arkansas and then Tennessee, and we were able to visit family and spend some time together in the mountains. And we came home late yesterday and walked into our empty house, and it was just kind of strange. Like, it didn't feel the same as all the family that we've been with for 2 weeks. But this morning, as people were filing in and I was able to shake hands and hug and everything, I was like, oh yeah, we do have family here in Orlando. And so it's just so great to be with you guys and to have this faith family together. So we're actually going to be continuing our series in the story of God. And this section of the series or of the story of God is really talking about separation from God. And we're dealing with really hard things. And today we're going to be finishing up the book of Genesis, which we've been in for a number of weeks, 10 maybe, something like that. And so Kelvin's going to come out and he's going to read from Genesis chapter 37.
Is it? Oh, yep. Good morning. Let's all stand for the word of God.
Yeah.
So it says, now Israel loved Joseph more than his other sons, because Joseph was son born of him in his old age. And he made a long-sleeved robe for him. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not bring themselves to speak peaceably to him. Then Joseph had a dream. When he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, listen to this dream I had. There we were, binding sheaves of grain in the field. Suddenly my sheaf stood up, and your sheaves gathered around and bow down to my sheaf. Are you really going to reign over us? His brothers asked him. Are you really going to rule us? So they hated him even more because of his dream and what he has said. Then he had another dream and told it to his brothers. Look, he said, I had another dream. And this time the sun, moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me. He told his fathers and brothers, and his father rebuked him. What kind of dream is this that you have? He said, am I and your mother and your brothers really going to come and bow down to the ground before you? His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. His brothers had gone to pasture the father's flocks at Shechem. Israel said to Joseph, your brothers, you know, are pasturing the flocks at Shechem. Get ready, I am sending you to them. I am ready, Joseph replied. Then Israel said to him, go and see how your brothers and the flocks are doing, and bring word back to me. So he sent him from the Hebron Valley, and he went to Shechem. A man found him there, wandering in the field, and asked him, what are you looking for? I'm looking for my brothers, Joseph said. Can you tell me where they are pasturing their flocks? They have moved on from here, the man said. I heard them say, let's go to Dothan. So Joseph set out after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They saw him in a distance, and before he had reached them, they plotted to kill him. They said to one another, oh, look, here comes the dream expert. So now, come on, let's kill him and throw him in one of the pits. We can say that a vicious animal ate him. Then we will see what becomes of his dreams. When Reuben heard this, he tried to save him from them. He said, let's not take his life. Reuben was also said to them, don't shed blood. Throw him into the pit in the wilderness, but don't lay a hand on him. intending to rescue him from them and return him to his father. When Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped off Joseph's robe, the long-sleeved robe that he had on. Then they took him and threw him into the pit. The pit was empty, without water. They sat down to eat a meal, and when they looked up, there was a caravan of Ishmaelites coming to Gilead. Their camels were carrying aromatic gum, balsam, and resin, going down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What do we gain if we kill our brother and cover up with his blood? Come on, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay a hand on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers agreed. When the Midianite traders passed by, his brothers pulled Joseph out of the pit and sold him for 20 pieces of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took Joseph to Egypt. That's God's word.
Thanks be to God. Thank you, Kelvin. And kids, you can be released to Children's Church. So one of the reasons that you might hear people say that they leave the Christian faith or they reject all religion, even the existence of God, is the reality of suffering and evil in this world. And we can imagine why. I mean, if we were to take this time and just talk about the different suffering that some of us are going through right now, we could fill the entire sermon time and then some. Or if we were to take another time and talk about the suffering that people have in their pasts that's still affecting them today, we could fill a second time. And so we can understand that there is a tension that people feel, like, if God is all knowing, he knows about my suffering, then why doesn't he stop it? If he's all powerful, he can stop my suffering, why doesn't he do that? And if he's good, then why does he allow me to suffer? Why does he allow evil and sin to permeate through our culture? I was just talking to Pat earlier today, and we were talking about how everybody's fighting right now. Just like wherever you go, everybody's mad at each other. And we just see so much brokenness in our world and evil and difficulty and suffering. And none of us has the solution for that. But one of the things that we need to remember in the midst of that is that the Bible isn't actually surprised, or the God of the Bible isn't surprised by the reality of suffering. If you read your Bible in the Psalms, there's a statement that sticks with me where the psalmist says, "Day and night, my tears have been my food." Like, some of us probably know exactly what that's like. Or there's a book in the Old Testament called Job. And Job takes 42 chapters. It's a really long book, talking about the suffering of one man and how he wrestled through that with God, and the unhelpful friends that entered into his life. And if you've suffered, you probably had some unhelpful friends like Job who have walked into that suffering with you. In fact, the Bible actually has a book about lament. It's called Lamentations. It's not a fun read. So we could even say that the Bible is a book about suffering written to a suffering people. The God of the Bible is not surprised by our suffering. And the story of Joseph is it's a huge fraction, 20 to 25% of Genesis, and it's really talking about the story of a man who went through a time of intense suffering that was ordained by a loving God. But before we get into the story, I do want to talk to those of you who are in this room and you're going through suffering right now actively. And maybe you're listening or you're here presently. I just want to thank you, because if you knew that the story of Joseph was coming, you probably knew that we were going to be talking about suffering and how God works in our suffering. And that's probably pretty painful for you to sit through. And I just thank you for being here, or for listening and for trusting me. I do hope to not belittle your suffering, but to encourage you in the midst of this difficult time. So as we go into this story of Joseph, it's in many ways a beautiful story. I was reading it when I read it through the first time. I was just impressed by how I couldn't put it down. It's just so such an interesting read, but it's also a very real read because of the suffering and the emotions that Joseph goes through during this time. And we're not going to be able to cover everything. Like I couldn't have Kelvin read the whole thing. It's like 13 chapters. We'd just be reading it. So we're going to be doing a lot of skipping stones. We're going to be doing a lot of summarizing. But let me tell you a little bit about Joseph. Joseph is the 11th son of Jacob. So he has 10 older brothers. And just like we have been listening to the story of Genesis and the story of the patriarchs over these past several weeks, this would have been things that were on the tip of their tongues. They would have understood these stories and heard these stories. They would have heard about how their great ancestors, Adam and Eve, sinned against God, and how there was a curse because of their sin. They would have heard how there was a promised seed of the woman who would crush the head of that evil serpent. They also would have heard about their, I think, great-grandfather Abraham and the promise that was made to him by God, who chose Abraham, set him aside, and he promised him, among all things, that nations and kings will come to you. And they also would have heard what Candy's husband told us last week, Jim, which was that the seed would not come in the way that you would expect through the oldest son in the family. But actually, there was a pattern of the younger son being the heir to that promise. And so Abraham does not have the promised son, Ishmael. Ishmael is not the son of the promise. It would be his younger brother, Isaac. And likewise, Isaac would have two children, but Esau would not inherit the promise. It would be his little brother, Jacob. So now Jacob has 12 children, and Jacob has a favorite child, his young son, Joseph, who he gives this robe of long sleeves. Now, this wasn't a Technicolor dream coat. This was the picture of a royal robe. You can imagine how his brothers must have felt. Wait a second. This is happening again. Our little brother has been coronated. And then little brother comes out with his dreams. And he starts talking about how he has these dreams of his brothers and even his father and his mother bowing down to him. So then, as his father sends Joseph to check on his brothers, which also must have irritated them, that he was constantly the supervisor going to make sure that they were doing what they were supposed to be doing. They saw him coming. And as Kelvin was reading earlier, they said, "We've got to do something about this. We got to get rid of this dreamer." And they decide to kill him. But then graciously, Judah decides, "Well, he's our own flesh and blood. Let's not kill him. Let's just sell him for 20 silver coins." And so that's what they do. They throw him into a pit. They strip his robe from him. And with that, they strip his identity, his dignity, and his family. They abuse him. They abandon him in a empty, dry well that's referred to as a pit. And through his suffering, Joseph refers to this in his entire story as the pit. His entire suffering, he looks at as that pit that he was thrown into. And at this point, it's hard for us to even imagine that Joseph would survive, much less that these things that he had been promised or that he had seen in his dreams would actually come true. Like, imagine you're laying there in the bottom of a pit that your family has put you into. And then when you are lifted out of the pit, it's by traffickers. At that point, it's hard to imagine that God was in this. It's hard to imagine that those dreams would come true. But the reality is that through his suffering, Joseph would save the nation of Israel and the entire region from certain death. And not only that, but this story could very much go a different way. Like, this is not a story of vengeance like the Count of Monte Cristo. That would be a really interesting story, but it's not the story that we get with Joseph. Instead, we get a story of forgiveness and reconciliation. And not to spoil the ending, but as the brothers come before Joseph, and he's put them through a lot at this point, and he's ready to reveal his identity to them, he says some things that are very interesting. He says in Genesis 45:6, "Don't be grieved or angry with yourselves for selling me here, because God sent me ahead of you to preserve life." And then later in Genesis 50, he says, "You planned this for evil, but God planned it for good, that many people would be saved through this." And so this is not a story of happenstance where Joseph just happens to, things just happen to work out for him. But he sees this as a loving God working through his suffering to bring about a greater purpose. So the big idea in our time together is that God is the trustworthy author of your story, showing his faithful provision even through suffering. And so we're going to use the metaphor that Joseph uses for his time of suffering, which is the pit. And we're going to talk about what does it look like when we fall into the pit? But what does it look like to stand up in the pit? What does it look like to see in the pit? And then what does it look like to rescue others from the pit? So first, let's talk about falling into the pit. When you fall into the pit, there's this moment of, it's really a time of kind of realizing and recognizing what's happening, like, because you almost don't want to accept what's going on. And maybe it's not even time to accept it. It's just kind of a time, like, I imagine Joseph falling into that pit, and he might have blacked out. Like, you can't even imagine physically what he just went through, being stripped, beaten, and thrown into a well. And so there's this moment of kind of seeing what's going on, recognizing it. And it's really the point when we begin to ask that question, why? Why would this happen to me? Why am I going through this? And there are a lot of reasons that we might come to, or people, going back to those unhelpful friends of Job, they might say things like, well, you must have done something to deserve this. Like, most of us tend to think that we get what we deserve. And okay, if something bad is happening to me, then that's because of this thing that I did in my past. Or maybe you're like me and something good happens, and you're like waiting on the other shoe to drop. You're thinking, okay, good things shouldn't happen to me because I'm not that good. So God's going to do something bad to counteract this good thing. And this is actually the view, or very close to the view, of Buddhism, which says we are the heirs of our own actions. So sometimes we face intense suffering and we just think, okay, God is punishing me. I've done something wrong. The second thing that people might say is life is just hard, right? Like, sometimes bad things happen. Life's full of its ups and downs, and sometimes there are more downs than there are ups, and you just deal with it. The Dread Pirate Roberts said it this way, life is pain. Anyone who says differently is selling something. It's your Princess Bride reference for the day. Friedrich Nietzsche said, "To live is to suffer. To survive is to find some meaning in the suffering." So Nietzsche isn't saying that there is meaning in the suffering. He's saying, in the meaningless suffering, you can just find something, you know, cope with it. It'll make you stronger and you'll be able to deal with it. This view, at best, pictures a deistic God who's just absent and just kind of sets things up and they just happen. Or perhaps it's there's no God at all, or he just doesn't care. But it's not the God of the Bible, even though there is sometimes seeming randomness to our suffering. Another thing that people might say is, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And we can resonate with this because we can probably look back at hard times in our lives and say, actually, I'm a better person because I went through that. And probably none of us want to be around the person who hasn't gone through any difficult times in their life because they're not usually that good to be around. The philosopher Seneca says, difficulties strengthen the mind as labor does the body. But I prefer the band AJR, who said, 100 bad days made 100 good stories. 100 good stories make me interesting at parties. So we may find some positives to each of these things, and they're probably things that do creep up in our minds when we suffer. And it's not to say that there's nothing true about these things, but it's to say that none of them truly account for Joseph lying in a pit, abandoned by his family. None of them give us a true, robust meaning in our suffering. And ultimately, they all fall short of what can truly bring comfort to us and just what is true about our suffering. And so I hope that in the course of looking at the story of Joseph, that we can see a more comprehensive, a more true meaning in our suffering. Now, the second thing that we're going to see is how Joseph stood up. We're going to see standing in the pit. Now, Joseph was trafficked by the Ishmaelites to Egypt, where he was purchased by a very powerful man named Potiphar. So Potiphar was described as the captain of the guard. He would have been like, some people say that he's like the chief officer of the whole military. Like, he's definitely a very very powerful man. And over the course of time, Potiphar starts to recognize that Joseph he's doing very well. He's trustworthy, and Joseph grows in his influence. In fact, Potiphar sees that basically the closer Joseph gets to him, and the more influence Joseph has over his household, the more things are going well. It says, and in fact, this is one of the few places where the Lord's presence in Joseph's life in the pit is acknowledged. It says, the Lord was with Joseph. This is in chapter 39. And he became a successful man serving in the household of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord made everything he did successful, Joseph found favor with his master and became his personal attendant. Potiphar also put him in charge of his household and placed all that he owned under his authority. From the time that he put him in charge of his household and all that he owned, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house because of Joseph. So Potiphar is being blessed because of Joseph. The Lord's blessing was on all that he owned in his house and in his fields. He left all that he owned under Joseph's authority. He did not concern himself with anything except the food that he ate. So Potiphar is noticing the faithfulness of Joseph and how he's standing in the pit. But there's also another person in the story who's noticing Joseph. It continues, now Joseph was well-built and handsome. After some time, his master's wife looked longingly at Joseph and said, sleep with me. But he refused. Look, he said to his master's wife, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in his house, and he has put all that he owns under my authority. No one in this house is greater than I am. He has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. So how could I do this immense evil, and how could I sin against God? Although she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her. Now, there's a really stark warning for us in this portion of the text, and that is that suffering is not a shield from temptation. In fact, I would go so far as to say that in our times of deepest suffering, we are the most vulnerable to temptation. We might think, I deserve something comforting. Like, maybe this is God giving me this thing because I've gone through so much. And you can see how this is a perfectly laid trap for Joseph. He's a young man. He's probably in his early 20s. He's a stud. It says that he's handsome. Yet, he has experienced rejection from his family. He's got daddy issues or family issues. And he probably deals with intense loneliness, because he is without his family. And he's starting to build a career for himself where he's gaining a lot of power. All these things are a cocktail or a recipe for a young man to fall to sexual temptation. And that is what he is given by Potiphar's wife, is just temptation. And in fact, the picture here is very similar to the garden in Genesis 3. Just the way that this is even written is kind of setting things up as Joseph being similar and yet different to Adam in the garden. I mean, notice that Adam and Eve, what are some of the things that we all kind of talk about that happened with them when they were tempted? So Eve looked at the fruit and she noticed that it was good to eat. It was beautiful. You don't see that with Joseph. Joseph never has a longing eye for Potiphar's wife. He doesn't toy with sin. He doesn't flirt with her. He continually rejects her. But we also see that in Adam and Eve, there's this focus on what they don't have. Well, we can eat from the other things, but we're not supposed to eat with this. Whereas Joseph spends a lot of time talking about everything that he has, and then just very briefly says, except you. Like, you're the one thing that I am not supposed to have for myself. So why would I do that? But then what's also interesting is that Joseph, as he talks about his master, he says, my master's given me all this. But then what does he come back around to? He says, so how could I do this evil thing and sin against God? And that's very interesting, because God is seemingly absent for a lot of Joseph's story. And yet Joseph recognizes that God's silence is not his absence, that God is there. And he shows that his moral compass was not broken whenever he fell into the pit, but that he's still the man in his suffering that he was before, and that he can trust God. Now the story continues. One day he went into his house to do his work, and none of the servants were there. So Potiphar's wife grabbed him by his garment and said, sleep with me. But leaving his garment in her hand, he escaped and ran outside. Joseph recognizes that this is the moment of truth. I've got to just get out of here. It doesn't matter what I leave behind. It doesn't matter that I don't have any clothes with me or how it looks. I've got to get out of here. And once again, in the story, Joseph is stripped of his garments. And with this second disrobing, he's stripped of his reputation, his job, and the comfortable life that he's earned for himself. And he gets out of there. Now, what's the result? You would think he would be rewarded for this, but no. Potiphar's wife goes to Potiphar, and she accuses Joseph of attempted rape, and Potiphar becomes angry and he throws him into prison. The prison, it's a maximum security prison. The Psalm describes the story of Joseph, and it talks about how he was in chains up to his neck, like a maximum security prison that was specifically for the king's prisoners. And he's thrown in there. Prison is a new rejection a new betrayal and a new pit for Joseph. But the next thing that we're going to see is Joseph seeing in the pit. So this next portion of the story, Joseph has once again, and the story moves very fast, Joseph's kind of come to this place again where he's doing really well for himself, because after a period of time, and this is probably years, he builds the trust of the keeper of the prison. And he shows his faithfulness, and the keeper of the prison puts him over everything. So he's kind of back in this place while in prison of being given as much power as that domain has and really being trusted. And then we get two new characters in the story, the chief baker and the cupbearer. Now, these seem like two kind of low-level people. You know, we think about how hard it is to hold a cup. But these two men were actually the last line of defense for what goes into Pharaoh's body. So this is the food and drink of Pharaoh. And they were more concerned with the safety of Pharaoh than they were the senses of Pharaoh. It's not just about how does the food taste, how does the wine taste, but they were there to protect Pharaoh, and they were trusted. And now they've come into prison. So we can kind of read between the lines and what probably happened. There must have been an attempt on Pharaoh's life. Maybe it was assumed that there could have been an inside job, or that somebody didn't do their job. And these two men are put into prison probably until they kind of sort out, all right, who actually did this? Who's responsible? What's going on? And Joseph is assigned to attend to them. So Joseph comes up to them one morning, and they've had some rough dreams, and they're talking, and he says, hey, what's going on? What's wrong? And so the cupbearer says, well, I had a crazy dream. And Joseph says, well, I know a thing or two about dreams. Why don't you share it with me? And so the cupbearer shares his dream with him. And Joseph says, you know what? This dream has a good interpretation to it. Because in 3 days, Pharaoh is going to lift your head, and you are going to be back in your role serving in the presence of the king. And so the baker hears this, and he's like, oh, there's good interpretations to these dreams. I thought it was a nightmare. So he comes to Joseph, and he says, well, let me tell you about my dream. And Joseph listens to the dream, and he says, okay, well, your head's also going to be lifted up, but it's going to be apart from your body. You're going to die. So the baker finds out, okay, I'm not going to make it. The cupbearer finds out, I'm actually going to be restored to my position. But what's really interesting about how Joseph interacts with them is he talks to the cupbearer, and he says, when you get back into your job, remember me. So he sees an opportunity, and I think it's important for us to recognize the tension that Joseph is holding right here and what it looks like to see in the pit. Because on the one hand, Joseph is content where he is. He's thriving. He's doing the best he can with what God has given him. But on the other hand, he sees that there might be an exit to the pit. And so I'm going to do what I can to at least put myself out there. And many of us probably experience that tension as well. If you're in a time of suffering, you might be dealing with the tension of, on the one hand, I want to suffer well, I want to be content, I don't want to become bitter, but on the other hand, I really want to get out of this pit. And that can look like a lot of things. It can mean you're praying for healing, but you're also kind of living in the reality of suffering with illness. Or you're working as hard as you can in a job that you hate, and you're looking for opportunities that maybe God will put you in a job that you would love more. Or maybe you're trying to increase your income, but you're also trying to manage what you do have really well financially. It can mean a lot of things. But I think it's important for us to recognize that we can hold that tension, that it's a good thing for us to do both things, to flourish where God has put us and to suffer well if that's what God has us doing, but then also to pray that God would take us out of those circumstances, that he would do something new and take us out of that pit. Both of these things can be held together. And in Joseph's case, the cupbearer doesn't keep his promise. He says, I'll remember you. He gets to his job and he completely forgets about Joseph. So for 2 more years after that, Joseph is still in prison. But then finally, we're going to see what it looks like rescuing from the pit. So the cupbearer does get to his place. And after 2 years, Pharaoh has a dream. And Pharaoh brings all the people around that he can. And he says, hey, can somebody interpret this for me? And nobody can. And that triggers the cupbearer. He says, oh, man, I messed up. There was this guy, this Hebrew, who can interpret dreams. And so they bring Joseph out of the pit. Kind of unceremoniously, he's taken out of prison. And Pharaoh describes his dream to Joseph. And Joseph gives him the interpretation. And he says, there's going to come 7 years where the land is just going to be abundant. We're going to see so much food, you won't even know what to do with it. But then after that, you're going to have 7 years of famine where people are going to forget about all that other food because it's so bad. They're just trying to survive. And he says, Pharaoh, you need to put someone wise and discerning over the land, and you need to have them take 20% of everything that comes over the next 7 years so that we can survive the 7 years after that. Maybe Joseph's being a little bit opportunistic here too. You know, he's probably thinking, hey, who's wise and discerning but the guy who just interpreted your dream for you? And it might be surprising that Pharaoh actually selects Joseph for the task. It may not be surprising for us because we're reading the story through Joseph's eyes, but from Pharaoh's standpoint, it's kind of odd that he would choose this Hebrew slave who was accused of attempted rape and all these things. And yet Pharaoh recognizes this is a wise and discerning man. This is a man who's been successful in everything that he's done. He's proven himself. He's trustworthy. He's wise. Let's put him over it. And this last point you might think would be being rescued from the pit. So we might think, oh, well, that's wrong. Rescuing from the pit, that doesn't make sense because you're supposed to get rescued from the pit. But really, there's not much focus in the text on Joseph coming out of the pit. Like I said, it's kind of unceremonious. But what happens is Joseph immediately is focused on being the rescuer of everyone else from the pit. This last stage of Joseph's story is all about saving others. And so Pharaoh gives to Joseph his signet ring. He gives him new clothes. And with those clothes, he gives him a clear purpose, a new identity. And he's suddenly starting to see that these dreams that I had have been fulfilled after 13 years of suffering. You know, and I think this focus on rescuing others is very characteristic of people who come through times of suffering or seasons of suffering. I work for a marriage and family ministry called Family Life. And what's interesting to me is most of the people who work there come from broken marriages that were restored or broken homes that they want to see others rescued from. They've gone through the pit and they don't want to see other people go through the pit in the way they did. So they want to get into the pit and navigate others through that. But in some ways, we never leave the pit, or at least the pit never leaves us. I mean, for most of us, there will always be a scar that we need to tend to, even as we're healing the wounds of others. The Apostle Paul says it like this: God comforts us in all our affliction so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any kind of affliction through the comfort we ourselves receive from God. So we go through these times, God gives us comfort, and we are expected to comfort others who go through similar times. And this is going to bring us closer to what the heart of the story of Joseph, all this 13 chapters of this story of Joseph, what is that about? And then why does God put us through times of difficulty and seasons of suffering? And the interesting thing is the story is not intended to be viewed only as about Joseph. The story is actually about one of his brothers, Judah. Judah, who sold his brother into slavery to make a buck. Judah, who, and we didn't get into this story, but he, at the same time that Joseph is showing purity and fleeing sexual temptation, Judah's just flat out seeking out sex and prostitution, and he's showing his rebellion against God. And the real danger that Judah is facing and all of Israel is actually not just the famine that they're to be saved from by Joseph. It's them abandoning the promise and their God, and how Judah intermarries with the Canaanites and he starts to entangle himself with the people of the land that they lived in. So the real danger is that not just the death of the family, but that the family would become just dissolved into the Canaanite people, and that we would see that the seed of the promise wouldn't be able to continue because there would be no godly line to go through. And perhaps the God of Israel would just be one other god of these people. And so Joseph and the Lord bringing the people from Canaan, which would be the promised land, to Egypt, actually has the effect of isolating them, because the Egyptians, they saw the Israelites as an abomination. They wouldn't so much as eat with them. And it allowed them to thrive. Like we're going to see between this week and next week's passage, as we get into Exodus, that they go from 70 people to a people that the Pharaoh in the future will say, they're going to overtake us. They've become a great nation. Like that's how much they grow in their time in Egypt. And I think similarly for us, God takes us through times of suffering to show us that this is not our home, to keep us from the entanglements of this world. If the Christian faith became a shelter from the suffering and evil of this world, then like Judah, we would just find ourselves becoming part of this world. We would find our joy in this world. But God gives us suffering, even real, deep, dark suffering, to grow us in our dependence upon Him and for us to see that this world is not what we should ultimately value. He's preparing us, just like the people of Israel, for the promised land. But He's first got to take us out of the land of Canaan. He's got to take our joy from this world and help us to grow closer to Him during that time. But knowing this doesn't shelter us from the physical and emotional tolls of the pit. I mean, it's through tears that Joseph would say to his brothers, "You planned evil against me, but God planned it for good." It's through tears that he would say, "God sent me here." And in fact, as you read the story, you might think Joseph's acting really strange when his brothers come, because he treats them really weird. He's kind of nice to them, and then he's really rude to them, and he's crying all the time. He's just ugly crying all over the place. But what he's doing is, one, he's experiencing the emotions of someone who's dealt with dark trauma, and his past is coming right back in front of him. And so even as this is a good time, that past is still with him. But then he's also testing his brothers to show to himself, and probably to show to them, that they've changed, that they can be reconciled. Before he even reveals himself to them, he's testing them with these different tests. And I think the reality of these emotions, and just the reality of suffering, and how even as we may know these truths, that God has a plan and a purpose, that doesn't necessarily protect us from the difficulties, the emotion, the pain. And so that's why it's really important for us, if we know someone who's going through suffering, that we treat these truths with care. The fact that God is in our suffering and that He has a plan and a purpose is not a bomb to throw into the pit and just hope that it blows up their worldview and that they suddenly deal with their suffering better. But it's a balm, B-A-L-M, where you can enter into their life, into the pit, and apply the balm patiently, lovingly, even with tears. And I think that's important, that we we see ourselves not leaving the truth behind, but also not staying out of the pit. We take our good theology, we take our good beliefs into the pit with us, but it's not the first thing that we bring up. The first thing that should come out of you is probably tears. The first thing you should do is hug, pray with them. And then maybe at some point they'll be at a place where you feel like you can talk through these things, but bring that good theology and just be a ministry of presence in their life in that moment, in the pit with them. Because rescuing from the pit ultimately comes from God himself. You see, unlike any other faith, the Bible doesn't merely present a God who is in control of our suffering, though he is, or who comforts us in our suffering, though he does. What we see in the story of God is that God actually entered into our suffering. You see, from Judah's line would ultimately come Jesus, the son of a man named Joseph. But Jesus would be an awful lot like the Joseph that we've been learning about. Like Joseph, Jesus was promised exaltation, but he was rejected by his brothers, even by the leaders of Israel. Like Joseph, Jesus was betrayed by those closest to him so that they could make a buck. Like Joseph, Jesus was stripped of his royal robe and beaten. He was thrown into the pit when he descended into the grave. But like Joseph, Jesus remained faithful to God through his suffering. Unlike Joseph, Jesus' righteous life can be ours. So you may be reading this story and thinking, I'm not like Joseph. I haven't withstood temptation. I haven't dealt well with suffering. I've thrown pity parties, or I've rejected God, whatever it might be. The next step for you, the call for you, is not be like Joseph. Just be better. The call for you is to look to Jesus, whose perfect life can be given to you, imputed to your account, that his suffering would give you hope in your suffering. So we must look to Jesus, the son of Joseph, in the midst of our suffering.